whether it is stable coin or it is cryptocurrencies or whatever you call it, I think we need to fully understand what are the risks before sort of trying to legitimize them.
The world of money is changing fast, and central banks are at the very center of that change. So if you're the bank governor for one of the fastest growing economies in the world, you need to tread carefully.
We need to know before entering the water how many sharks are there inside the water.
Shaktikanta Das is the governor for the Reserve Bank of India, which is responsible for regulating currency and securing monetary stability for the world's fifth largest economy. Das is also an innovator and a pioneer when it comes to central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs.
CBDC is going to be the future currency of the world. And it is necessary that every central bank, every country works on CBDCs.
In this program, Governor Shaktikanta Das sits down with the IMF's Krishna Srinivasan to discuss RBI's strategy for today and for the future.
So, Governor, let's begin with what we've seen in Asia. What you've seen in Asia is inflation started rising much later than other regions of the world. When it started rising, it rose much less, and now it's declining faster than other parts of the world. Was that the experience in India too? And if so, how would you explain that?
Yeah, I think first, good afternoon to all of you. And thank you very much, Krishna, for giving me this opportunity. Thank you to you personally and to the IMF. And very happy to see you all this afternoon. Now, coming to the inflation scenario in India, yes, by and large, what you say is right. And I think the primary, I will say in the context of India, I think the primary reason for that was that the COVID time response of both the monetary authority, that is the Reserve Bank of India, and the government from the fiscal side, I think the response of both fiscal and monetary authorities were very calibrated and targeted. There was no excessive fiscal expansion, excessive compared to other countries, because the government did enhance substantially the fiscal targets were extended during that time. It was widened. The government went for a higher fiscal deficit. So when I say it was not excessive fiscal support in comparison to many of the advanced economies. And also on the monetary side, we took very calibrated measures during that period. While we provided a very strong support to the financial markets with a commitment to see that the financial markets function normally and the normal activities go on in the financial markets. So we undertook number of measures. We undertook, for example, we pumped in a lot of liquidity. We pumped in, we reduced the policy repo rates, the interest rates by 215 basis points on top of a few rate hikes which we had done earlier. So liquidity, then we did the adjustment of rates, reducing the rates. And we also provided support to the lenders, that is to the banking companies and to the non-bank lenders, by first offering a moratorium of 6 months, followed by a resolution framework with regard to the loans which were under stress. So, and all these responses were very calibrated. Just to give one example, we injected liquidity, but almost every liquidity injection measure was accompanied by a end date, by announcing an end date, by announcing a sunset date. So for example, when we gave liquidity, it was given for 1 year, or it was given for 3 years. So, and the lending standards, the collateral standards were not diluted. It was the banks which availed the credit, and the collateral standards were not diluted or compromised. And right from day one, the bank knew very well that they have to return this much quantum of liquidity, say after 1 year or after 3 years. So they were able to plan their liquidity management better. So that is just one example which I am giving. So by and large, therefore, in India, the monetary and fiscal response were very calibrated, very targeted. And simultaneously, I think the supply side management and the steps which were taken by the government also during that period, it did help us to sort of bring down, it did help us to sort of see that the inflation was kept under check. And naturally, due to a combination of all these factors, I think the inflation spike in India came a little later, maybe, compared to what you were saying. In fact, I would even go to the extent of saying that without the war in Ukraine, our inflation, would have been very much within our target range. Our inflation target, as all of many of you would know, is 4%,
right,
with a tolerance band of 2% on either side. So in February of 2022, when we did the monetary policy statement, our projection for the next financial year, 22-23, that is commencing April 22 up to March 23, our projection of inflation average was 4.5%, very close to our target of 4%. But then the war commenced. With that, the commodity prices just hit the roof, particularly the prices of crude oil. Then access to, like the supplies of wheat and other cereals got affected. International prices went up. India, despite being surplus in wheat, our domestic wheat prices also went up because we are also linked to the international market.
Right.
And India does export, we do export, India exports quite a bit of wheat also. Then the edible oil prices, a substantial quantum of edible oil which India imports from that region of, from Ukraine, Russia, from that region, that also got disrupted. So I would say, but for the onset and the unexpected onset of the war in Europe, over Ukraine, I think our inflation would have been very much under control.
You alluded to one point. You said that the war in Ukraine kind of led to a sharp rise in prices. Now, we've had a series of shocks, right? From the pandemic, then we had the war in Ukraine, the commodity price shocks. In this context of series of shocks, how have we been able to balance price stability, growth, and financial stability objectives of the RBI's monetary policy framework?
Actually, if you see over the last 5 years, we have seen a series of shocks, and some of them were also quite overlapping. In the second half of 2018 calendar year, there was the failure of a large non-bank lender. Mm-hmm. That created a lot of stress in the financial markets, and the financial market activity almost came to a standstill. Liquidity was also under a lot of pressure. So we had to address, and that whole of 2019, it took us to adjust to manage that situation. Mm-hmm. So we did that by, we had a very close monitoring of all the non-bank lenders. The top 100 non-bank lenders were being monitored at my level on weekly basis. And we tried to inject liquidity, and we ensured that there was no other failure of a major non-bank lender during that period. That was 2019, 2020 was COVID. 21 was the Delta wave, 22 yes. was the Ukraine war, and 23 has not ended, and too many things are happening all around. So that is the kind of crisis which we have gone through. But in all this, I think what has helped us is what has really made, enabled us to manage this situation is that we have always been proactive. We have tried to identify the problem, and we acted before the problem actually occurred. For example, during COVID time, in the month of March itself, when COVID was just setting in, and there was a state of lack of clarity in everybody's mind as to what this virus is all about, what kind of damage it will cause. But very proactively, and I think with somewhat great boldness on the part of a central bank, which is supposed to be very conservative, I think displaying some sense of some kind of a boldness and with a lot of proactiveness, we announced a moratorium on repayment of loans to banks and to non-bank lenders. We were clear that we will do it for 6 months, but we announced it in two phases. First, we gave 3 months because we thought we'll see how the virus plays out, how it behaves. And if required, we gave it for another 3 months. So this came before even there was a demand from the market, asking for this kind of a relief. So we did it proactively. And then we came out with a resolution package. I mentioned to about yes. it earlier, a COVID-19 resolution package to address the problem of stress in the banks. And when we came out with the resolution framework, it was not a kind of open-ended framework where it was free for all for the banks to restructure the loans any way they want. We formed a committee, and the committee prescribed certain financial and operational parameters which the lender has to achieve post, you know, after the, you know, post restructuring of a particular loan. Yeah. When you restructure a loan, then let us say the period of restructuring, we said, should be not more than 2 years. And these are the financial and operational parameters which the borrower has to achieve. In other words, it also entailed a kind of a responsibility on the part of the borrower himself to bring some additional capital and to do some internal business corrections. So therefore, our actions have been, by and large, we have tried to be proactive. You know, we no more wait for the symptoms to sort of warn us. We have now early warning exercises. We do deep dive into the business models of banks or non-bank lenders and try to identify which are the potential areas of risks. And we sensitize the banks or the non-banks. We don't do micromanagement. We don't unnecessarily
interfere. So this early warning is new? The early warning is a new phenomenon you use?
Early warning system internally was there.
Okay.
It was not as if the Reserve Bank was doing it for the first time. It was there, but we sharpened it and we further tightened it. So on the financial sector, we focused. Liquidity, I have mentioned. Rates, of course, in response to inflation, we have sort of again increased the rates when the need arose for that. And last but not the least, very important, during this entire period starting 2019 till now, and the process continues, we have built up a strong forex reserve position in the Reserve Bank.
Right.
Our forex reserves have almost been increased by 70 to 80%. We today stand, our reserves stand at around 600 billion, a little less than 600 billion as per the latest number. But it is around 600 billion US dollars. And in the beginning of 2019, it was just about 390 or little less than 400 billion dollars.
Right.
It was a conscious decision to build up the reserves as a buffer, as an insurance against the spillover risks. When you have capital inflows, there will be a day when there will be capital outflows. And in such situations, every country, especially emerging market economies, which always face the consequences of spillovers of actions or what's happening all around, the spillovers are felt maximum by the EMDs, by the emerging market and developing economies. Ultimately, these economies have to look after themselves. And India, with a huge population and with the size of our economy, we have to be self-reliant, we have to be self-dependent, we have to have our strong reserves. So with that objective, we have been building up very strong reserves, and in fact, that has given great confidence to the market that whatever be the challenge, India will be able to meet its external sector obligations. And that is something which did help us even this time around after the Ukraine war, when there was depreciation of the, you know, when the US dollar suddenly became very strong and all the emerging market currencies depreciated. The Indian currency, the Indian rupee, did not depreciate as much because the market had confidence that the Reserve Bank, that India will be able to meet its obligations. And even during this period, we were intervening in the market. I am saying it openly. I will not hesitate to say for a moment that we do intervene in the market, but our intervention is both ways. Sometimes we, buy dollars, sometimes we sell dollars. It depends on which way the market is moving. But our objective is not to fix, to have the rupee at a particular level. We don't have a particular level of the Indian rupee in our mind vis-a-vis the dollar. We don't have a specific exchange rate in our mind when, with regard to our currency market intervention. What we are attempting to do, and this has been RBI's philosophy and approach over the last several decades, Our approach and our focus, our emphasis is to prevent excessive volatility of the exchange rate. Because once you have, you are able to provide stability to your currency, once you are able to achieve a kind of orderly depreciation or appreciation, depending on where the market moves or depending on what is the overall global and domestic situation, it has to be an orderly movement of the currency and there should not be excessive volatility. So that is what we have sort of ensured, and as a result, and we are quite open about it, and in fact this is one area where I think it is necessary for for agencies and others who do this labeling of market intervention. I think it's a time to rethink. I mean, there is a perception that central bank must have autonomy. Central bank does have autonomy. Autonomy means autonomy in decision making. Autonomy does not mean that you stop conversation between each other.
Absolutely. I fully agree with both on coordination and communication. I think you raise excellent points. If I could just move to a different issue. India has been leading the front on digitalization. You know, when they talk about digital public infrastructure, you talk about digital money, digital payments, and so on. And you yourself have been the pioneer in the issue of CBDCs. And you've been piloting this, and I think now you're trying to mainstream it. What role do you see of CBDCs and digital payments playing in the Indian economy in terms of improving financial inclusion, innovation, and efficiency?
Well, thank you. I'm happy that you asked that question, because CBDC is going to be the future currency of the world. And it is necessary that every central bank, every country works on CBDCs. There's one reason, specific reason why I am saying that. Of course, paper currency will continue because that is the kind of a fallback, that is the kind of an insurance against. Just imagine if there is a massive technology disaster or some massive shock, then, how do the transactions go on? So paper currencies will remain. They provide the necessary insurance against, against a possible or what may look unlikely, but nothing is unlikely in today's world. So that is the kind of a insurance for such crisis situations. But having said that, the world is moving towards digital payments. India has made excellent progress, and it's at the forefront of digital payments. Our UPI per day number of transactions have exceeded 10 billion transactions per month we are doing now, the UPI is doing. Coming to CBDCs, why I am saying it is very important? Because there are several, there are now several new animals or birds, whatever you call them, they're floating around under various names. Somebody calls it stable coins, somebody calls it cryptocurrencies. Our point of view is that let us be very careful in interpreting and understanding what consequences they have. On stable coins, the fundamental question that begs an answer is whether governments and central banks are comfortable with private currency. Currency is a sovereign function which the sovereign delegates to the central bank in countries like India. So therefore, are we comfortable with private currency? So therefore, this new technology products which are coming and styling themselves as great innovation, their financial consequences, their negative consequences for domestic financial stability, for global financial stability, for domestic monetary system, for the global monetary order, all that needs to be understood. And we have published, RBI, we have myself spoken about it, so I'm not going to list out what are the potential threats. Right. They pose a threat, all kinds of threats, terror financing, money laundering, apart from, currencies like emerging market currencies, which will sort of cause the central bank itself will lose control over the monetary system. There are lots of challenges, and this these are highly risky. Now, we don't want that kind of a thing. In fact, on such matters, whether it is stablecoin or it is cryptocurrencies or whatever you call it, I think we need to fully understand what are the risks before sort of trying to legitimize them. We need to know before entering the water how many sharks are there inside the water. I think that is how I would put it in a very commonplace language and very bluntly. Now, so therefore CBDC is important. The world is moving towards technology, and CBDCs have a major role, because CBDC can really facilitate efficient, cost-effective, and faster payments across jurisdictions. For cross-border payments, yeah. For cross-border transactions, CBDC can provide the solution. Even today, time is taken. Bank-to-bank transactions do take time. In fact, there is a cost. According to the latest estimates of the World Bank and others, still remittances cost about on an average 6% is the total cost for remittances. Now 6% is very high. It needs to go down in today's technology era. It needs to go down. So CBDC can provide a solution to make cross-border payments faster, more efficient, and cost effective. In India, Reserve Bank, we started the wholesale CBDC pilot project in November last year, and the retail mode we started in December. In the wholesale, initially we started with secondary market trading in government securities. Now we are extending it to overnight money markets, that is the wholesale segment. In the retail segment, we have now millions of customers who are enrolled into the pilot project. Almost every bank has been onboarded. The trials are going on. It's a learning experience for us. And the learning process has been very satisfactory. And every day there are new challenges which come. We try to understand what is the problem. So we are really taking it forward in a manner. And on this, we are in active discussion also with other countries which are carrying out similar efforts. So now it's just about going to be a year of our, 1 year of our CBDC pilot project. The learnings have been excellent, and more than what it was 1 year ago, we are even more convinced that CBDC can prove to be the most effective and efficient mode for cross-border payments in particular, other than, of course, domestic transactions. And this is not something which is very difficult. In fact, in India, we have a small, vegetable vendors who have been enrolled into this CBDC pilot project. Fruit shops, small vegetable vendors, they're all onboarded. And we have in India made our CBDC and the UPI interoperable.
Yes. Yes.
So it is not necessary that for the e-rupee, you have one QR code, and for UPI, you have another QR code. In fact, UPI first, we had streamlined the QR codes. It's a common interoperable QR code. Now the same QR code is interoperable with the CBDC. So naturally, the efficiency of the system improves.
Great. Governor, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your ideas and wisdom with us. It was really useful for all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Governor of the Reserve Bank of India, Shaktikanta Das, speaking with IMF Asia and Pacific Department Head, Krishna Srinivasan. The event took place as part of the Governor Talks series held during the annual meetings in Marrakesh last month. You can watch a webcast of the event at imf.org. You'll also find more of these IMF podcasts at imf.org/podcasts or on the platform of your choice. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.